720 WGN. A good Saturday morning to everyone
out
there.
Good
morning.
Good morning, Chicago.
Hey, everybody. How you doing? It's John Hanson and the wonderful Esmeralda Leon. How you doing, babe?
I'm good.
I just called you babe.
Aww.
That was weird. Is that okay? Do you feel offended by that?
No.
Anyone ever call you babe? Just kind of on? And that, and you're okay with that?
Yeah.
All right. Just making sure. We're filling in for Matt Bubala here on this Saturday morning. And we're so happy to be joined by Roger Banish in the news. Roger.
Well, hi, lady and gentlemen.
Welcome back. I'm
Thank
not a
you.
Gentleman, and you know that. Don't lie about that. Everything all good in Rogerland now, right? You're all good? You're feeling better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sort of.
That's fine.
As much as it can be?
Is that what you tell the doctor, too?
Yeah, no, I tell him everything's rotten. Yeah. He looks at me and laughs because he's got both hips replaced. he's in worse shape than I am.
Oh, gosh.
Well, that's good.
That's the barometer.
Yeah, that's just the humor.
As long as you're in better shape than the doctor, you're fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, my wife's got a new name for me now. It's Quasimodo.
Oh.
Yeah, because of the way I walk around holding my head.
I'm your Esmeralda.
What a Esmeralda.
Oh, we could do that for a theater play. Let's do live readings of The Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Perfect.
Let's pull up a script for that if we can, Tom Hush. Roger, so chime in, of course, all morning long. It's so good to have
you
here.
You
I missed you last week. Yeah. Tom Hush, how is your week shaping up?
Pretty well.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm having a good week so far. Having a good weekend now.
Yeah, now we're in the weekend time. Esmeralda, have a good week?
Yes.
I heard you on Nick this morning, or I guess Friday, yesterday morning, technically.
Yes.
And you've been having some weird sleeping times.
Well, no. Well, it's because I want to do stuff.
Okay.
I want to do things, so I have to sleep in weird things. Like today, I slept from 6 p.m. to 11.
Yeah. And because you did the axe throwing at noon.
Right.
Right, right,
yeah,
exactly.
So I slept three. My body will not let me not sleep 8 hours now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting to realize. Because I slept 3 in the morning, and then I got the rest later.
You got I've noticed that. I don't know. Do you do that pretty well? Like if you're able to do 2 and then plus 6 later on?
No.
Nope. Yeah. It's
usually not. And today my body's like, nope. No, we have 8 hours. We need 8 hours. We're going to do this.
Mm-hmm. 312-981-7200. We've got a really cool show. We kind of teased the Arlen Parsa thing coming up in the, but that's going to come up in a little bit later on in the show. But we got some music coming up later and we have to talk about this fire festival, fire spelled F-Y-R-E. And I'll pull up the article and give everyone the full primer. But basically, it's this insanely overdone, crazy festival in the Bahamas that was supposed to be taking place this weekend and next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a rich kid festival.
It's a rich kid festival. Yeah, that's the best way to put it.
Pretty much.
And
trust fund baby festival.
Yes. And it has completely blown apart and gone terribly, and now it is canceled.
Yes, and the internet is just going real hard on them.
Just loving it, because it you know, no, nothing better than watching trust fund babies have a bad time.
Yeah.
Although, if anyone's coming home from that festival, we'd love to hear from you.
I would, yeah, I just want to know that someone went and is listening to WGN.
Yes, and because I don't think we make it all the way down to the Bahamas, but we'll find out.
I don't think they have radios.
Yeah, call us if you need us to get you out of there. People are literally stranded on this island. 312-981-7200 if you want to chime in about that or any other subjects. Just a crazy kind of week of news. I don't think we're going to touch much about Trump's 100 days, which maybe will be welcome news to some of our listeners.
I think it got covered.
We'll leave that at bay. Yeah,
it got covered.
Any of them covered that.
I just know it was 100 days.
Yeah, 100 days. I have some thoughts, but I'm not going to share them here this morning. Okay, so a lot coming up here on 720 WGN.
Woke up this morning with a couple complications. Blood vessels in my eyes burst and my heart of palpitations. Had to rearrange my atoms around a broken valve to get the blood flow to the muscles. At least to the fat, and had I taken just a second to measure my resources, had I lost myself to doubt, I doubt I'd ever have resurfaced. This is not a problem, it's another sunrise toxic. This is waking up, and these days it's a process.
720 WGN, Esmeralda Leon, John Hanson in for Matt Bubala. Ooh, yeah, I didn't. I should get reverb ready for when we do that in the future. you were listening there to Paul Harris, who joins us now here in studio. Paul, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Good, very good. Hey, you got a little napping before you came in today?
I did. It was great. I'm get a little nap voice, but I'll get
through. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, you get a little nap voice. Yeah.
Did you take
good.
It in the green room?
I was gonna, but there was like a party in there. I felt very antisocial.
All right, so Paul, what were we just hearing, by the way? What song is that?
That was called, to put it correctly for radio, that was Darn the Algorithm That Matched Us.
Ah, okay. So, Paul, you are a musician here in Chicago, and I find it fascinating that where are you from originally?
I'm from England originally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's going on? Yeah, obviously. That accent gave it away.
Just a quick vent. I'm pretty sure that from no other country, if you mention you're from there, do people go, but you don't have an accent.
Right.
And well, I mean, like, Ireland,
you would expect
Scotland,
it, though.
Yeah.
So when did you move to the United States?
So the first time I moved here, I was 3. And
it
then
didn't
I left
take.
When I was 4.
Okay.
And then back when I was 5. And so on.
Just every other year? Did you come
really?
Back and
just in other places as well. So,
are your parents from
my
originally
parents
from
are from England.
Okay.
Yeah, from Wolverhampton in London.
And you just became a citizen last year.
I did.
Boy, you very picked nice. An interesting year to
well,
become
thinking,
a citizen here in the United States.
Just lock it in, though, right?
The deadline was coming up admin-wise, and it was like, well, the rules are as such now.
Right.
It sounds like they might change
right.
potentially. And,
yeah.
you know, turns out that was a prudent decision.
Yeah. No, it was very good.
So how do you describe your music? It's kind of playful. I really like just listening to a little bit. Our producer sent us a couple samples, and I was just like, oh, it's fun. It's got a light feel to it, but it can tackle serious subjects, but also have a playful stuff with the lyrics and also just a fun strum of the guitar. I don't know.
Right. And that last song, I immediately thought Paul Simon.
Oh, thank you.
Wow.
Okay. I'll take.
Good. That's
really?
Quite a...
You didn't hear
no,
that? I was like,
oh, no, I definitely hear it. That's, I'm
that
sure you
Paul
what
Simon-y.
I was going to say.
Visually, I've always been more of a Garfunkel.
So, yeah, talk about your music. How did you get started in playing guitar and singing and writing these quirky lyrics?
I started playing guitar like when I was 6 years old, way back when, because that was like the enforced instrument. And then I assumed the whole point of that was to write songs.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
So I started when I was like 8 writing songs.
Right,
none of those songs were good, obviously.
Is your family musicians? Do they play as
not
well?
Not really. My dad plays drums in his spare time, but he wanted us to be cooler than he was.
Oh.
So when you say you started writing lyrics when you were 8 and they weren't good, but I imagine that that's such a skill to pick up that it's good. I mean, if you're going to start writing, it's just like anything. The
I'm
earlier
really
you
glad
start.
I started young, yeah.
And what have you learned, you know, obviously you talk about moving around all over the place. Does that influence mm-hmm. your music and what you write?
Yeah, I think that's like the underlying neurosis or whatever beneath it all is kind of having to go everywhere, which is a great, really fun opportunity or whatever. But you have to kind of assimilate everywhere you go. Not like people force you, but it's just a smart thing to do. If 9 people in the room agree on something, wait for them to explain it further before you kind of ask your
sort of like a defensive
questions.
Mechanism.
Yeah. And so like writing songs became my way of venting things I didn't understand about mm-hmm. the world in a nice, safe way, usually hidden with jokes.
Right.
Kind of thing. So I do like looking at I don't know to what extent I'm successful, but I do like looking at things that happen culturally that maybe we don't think about.
For example,
unless you were sort of outside of things. So
not to put you on the spot.
Oh,
right?
No worries. You'd think I'd have an example. So, like, the song we listened to, Darn the Algorithm, mm-hmm. that matched us, is sort of, it was just a reflection on all the things you're looking at when you're swiping, sort of on Tinder or whatnot.
Really?
All the range of different behaviors, and also how there's trends in there. Like, there's all sorts of acceptable behavior by gender sort of thing, mm-hmm. which is interesting. So a lot of women's profiles are understandably pretty specific and explicit in what they want and don't want. And you can assume they've been through some pretty awful messages to get to that point kind of thing. But it's also very like task mastery. Like you must be this, this, and this. It's like, oh, well, I might as well not even
swipe there. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess left out of respect. Or is it right? I don't even know which way is correct.
So that song was very Paul Simon-y. What are your other, would you say, your other influences?
The first musician that I like really loved was Ben Folds.
Mm-hmm.
Ben Folds 5.
Also a guy that really paid close attention to his lyrics
yeah.
and
right.
the story they told.
And he always slipped, like it always seemed to be a joke or something.
Yes,
but
yeah, yeah.
It was fun. Like his song, One Angry Dwarf
yes.
and 200 Solemn Faces was my favorite as a kid.
That song
know,
is
short.
Very good, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I often find that, and sorry I keep on focusing on the lyrics, but that's immediately what caught me about the song we just listened to, is that the best lyrics are the ones that they don't sound like they take too long to write, or they sound, it's very easy. There's just a general ease to them, I guess you could say. But it's really complicated to form these things together. Obviously, you want to say what you want to say, make the point that you want to make, while at the same time following the natural rules of rhythm that we are, you know, structured to follow, while also still playing with that a little bit. So that's got to be – it's got to be fun to play with it.
I do. I think that's one of the reasons my songs are mostly like 2 to 3 chords, because by the time I get to that point, I'm like, wow, I spent a lot of energy. No one's going to notice if this one's in G,
right,
as well as the last one.
Mm-hmm. Do you perform around Chicago, all over the area? Do you perform elsewhere?
Just Chicago. I need to get me a driver's license.
Oh, yeah. Better hurry up and get on that.
Yeah.
What sort of venues around the city?
Sort of the smaller,
yeah,
homier ones. Places like, well, I do Uncommon Ground every once in a while. Mm-hmm. Lily's Bar in Lincoln Park, Sylvie's Tavern. Sylvie's something or other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Elbow Room. You get the gist.
Yeah. No, I mean, and that's the thing, is that you just became a citizen, for God's sakes.
Right.
No, but that's interesting because, you know, when you think of, you're obviously not going to go play a, I mean, hopefully one day you'll be playing these big venues and this will be great.
Yeah, I'd like to fill a small one first.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's where, I mean, that's where you really cut your teeth at this sort of stuff, especially with your kind of style of music. I think it's it seems very intimate, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
So it's nice. I mean, I don't want to, I mean, of course you want to be performing one day in front of 20,000 people, but performing in front of a couple hundred must be a really interesting learning experience.
It absolutely is. I've been performing this stuff since I was like a teenager, when things are drastically different. Mm-hmm. But then at that point I learned, like, if you're not happy with 2 people in the room, you're probably not going to be happy with more. Like, if you can't have that happen well, then the rest of it's pointless.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, it's genuinely fun. Like, sometimes when I play Lily's, we just throw the windows open and you'll start with 2 or 3 people. But if you can pull people in,
wow,
you know, right, a nice little bar, and it's people who all came in because they heard something they liked, and it's much more of a back and forth. And I'm more comfortable with that sort of thing than I am sitting there being really serious and pretending.
That's the second time you kind of mentioned being comfortable. You mentioned that in the green room you felt socially awkward. Is that something that you feel? Do you feel awkward in big groups?
Absolutely. I think that's just been conditioned to the thing at this point. I always feel a little outsidery, even though I'm probably not. But I also like, I don't know, I like to play on that in writing, mm-hmm, kind of thing. Like, I'm never comfortable. Let's lean into it.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens here.
And we're going to hear some stuff.
Yeah, right? We are going to hear some stuff after the news. I want to get your take on this Fyre Festival, because we've been talking about this. Again, for people listening, it's a festival that, what is the name of this island? It's like a remote island.
Exumas.
Exumas, and
it's in the
Ja
Bahamas.
Rule and this other guy.
No, not Ja Rule. Or is it Ja Rule?
It's Ja Rule.
It's Ja Rule.
Is it Ja Rule? Okay.
Like, it was Ja Rule.
And someone else funded it.
Yeah, right? some 25-year-old former banker guy funded it. They one time were flying on a private plane, Ja Rule and this guy, his name escapes me. They ran out of gas and they landed on this island, and then they were like, oh, I also like rap, let's have a festival here, this will be great. The problem is the island has absolutely no infrastructure for running water, things like that, but sure, let's bring hundreds and thousands of people to this island, try and get them there and host a 2-weekend festival.
Right. It looked cool. The idea of it.
The concept looked cool. Well, what they've been doing then is they had a bunch of influencers, supermodels and stuff,
right,
paid influencers, trying to hype this sort of thing up. Would you ever want to play a festival on a Bahama island?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even if it's that one, I'd go. Soldier through it. I don't even need to be plugged in.
Well, then here's the thing. Why do they cancel it? Next weekend, Paul Harris
is going to
be, you'll be the one.
I'll eat the cheese sandwiches labeled as gourmet cuisine. I don't mind.
So you really do have to find this photo, article online, because just to see the differences, and Twitter went crazy.
Yeah.
Because, they were promised that it was going to be this luxurious accommodations.
Yeah, they're going to live in these gorgeous huts on
these
beach.
Cabanas, yeah.
And they turned out to be big white tents.
Yeah,
what's it called?
Big tents.
There's a word for them.
Pods or something?
Tents they use in like emergency situation.
Disaster relief tents.
Disaster relief tents.
That's right. And I think the cheapest ticket was like $4,000.
$4,000.
So you're paying no less than $4,000 for things like bread and cheese.
Right.
Disaster relief tents.
Yeah.
A bar ran out of beer.
Which is the worst
festival
problem of all.
I could deal with cheese sandwiches, but run out of beer, I'm like, come on.
Yeah, actually, the cheese sandwich didn't look all that bad, personally. I would have
it was
eaten
a gourmet
that.
Cheese sandwich.
Cheese sandwiches.
But basically, everyone got, the people that had already gotten there on Thursday and earlier today, essentially got stuck because they don't have the infrastructure to get them out. So there are people that were just stranded with literally no place to stay.
Yeah, they were stranded both ways because at one point they stopped letting people, flights were not going in and flights were not going out.
Yeah, because the airport is only, everyone was going to Miami, then they were privately flying everyone to this island. But there is, and then a storm came through. Oh, so people were talking about surviving this festival, and it
which
never
is
even
laughable,
started. And then Blink-182 dropped out, and then Esmeralda and I had a fight.
We had a fight.
We'll get your thoughts on Blink-182 after the break, after the news.
Depends on what decade we're in.
Right? It does evolve. It does evolve. Okay, we're going to have more music from Paul Harris on the way and plenty more here on 720 WGN. But right now it is 2:30. Look at this, Roger. We are on time.
Look I'm at living in a dream world.
You are. 720 WGN.
Like an island in the Bahamas.
Not yet. Yeah,
with
not
cheese sandwiches?
With cheese sandwich.
Ooh, I like a good cheese sandwich.
And it's news time. Here's Roger Badish.
I was stunned as a false god appeared, bade me step up, leave a hollow cause to ruin, slap on some cheap veneers and cultivate some self-importance, misconstrue it as conviction, said he wouldn't answer questions until I improve my diction or I learn to tie a tie, keep my money in my wallet, learn them pre-approved lies, and I found a way to turn a profit and a blind eye to inconsistency. Leave broken hearts for doubt. Watch you bleed from my beliefs. I watch you bleed for freaking out. I'm freaking out. Is this a tumor or is it something worse? Like some true or tried part of my person. Another charming voice for my perversions, or maybe just a version of me you prefer. Seemed like food for thought, but I wasn't feeling hungry, I'm sure. I was a few too deep, too dumb, too desperate for money, so I put it off a day, I put it off like 10 more years. I was ruled by my avoidance, or I found the whole thing weird, or I wasn't in the mood. The mood just didn't take me, while that fervor fought for focus, I just felt myself spacing and the emptiness remains. It fills me to the brim. I watch you kids with causes drown. I float, but I don't swim. I guess I'm lacking in commitment. I care not for your insistence. You got everything to lose, claiming the infinite. And I got nothing but time. Part of me collapses in a heap outside your door. I'm seeing ghosts and old friends. You contemplate divorce. Throw my songs on the fire and realize what might have been might not have been worth it. If you'd have let it sit, I let things sit and rot and fester. They gain sentience and thrive. It's neck and neck. Am I trying to kill myself? Am I trying to stay alive? I feel alive. Kind of sometimes. Far gone and drawn right into it. Some filthy, false, gosh darn hypocrite. Just wasting all of your time.
Woo! That was so good!
Yeah!
Paul Harris! Nice job! What was that called?
That was called False God.
False God. What inspired you to write that song?
There's a certain number of songs. This is one of them that I like brain rants that happened when I was supposed to be doing something else. So that was a final exam song from school.
Really?
Where sometimes I was like, need to take 5 minutes and write this down so that I can focus on the thing they're asking.
That's really good. It's so catchy.
Yeah.
It makes you smile, but it makes you think.
Yes.
Music's amazing.
Did that, so that was just, was it in one sitting?
Mm-hmm.
Is that really? Usually the thing, or?
It's like it goes either way. I much prefer the one sitting ones. Mm-hmm. Gotta say, they're a lot more fun. When I'm trying to say something really thought out, then it takes a bit longer because I do a lot more editing. But that one came out more or less as is, and then just a few tweaks here and there.
Is that usually how it goes?
Yeah.
If you have those one-and-dones, like, do you just leave it?
Pretty much. I try not to edit it too much. I just try to do, if I rant a bit too much, which is what I call that writing, it's like sometimes certain, what's the word, idiosyncrasies come up. It's like, well, we'll just adjust that. That's just you being negative.
Do you like being a soloist, or do you wish you had a band around you?
I haven't been in a band in a while.
Okay.
I do like a good jam. I used to be part of a duo called Naked Picnic here, which is much
which
the
sounds like fun.
It was. That was our whole vibe. Bit of fun. Have a drink. Mm-hmm. It was basically the same general thing, but in harmony. I found having another guy up there made me seem much more, what's the word?
Palatable?
That's the one.
Oh. Well, I mentioned it's just, yeah, it's nice to have someone to help you out and rely on when it's all you. I mean, it's a lot of pressure. But at the same time, you've got complete editorial and creative license over what you do when you're up there by yourself.
That part I do like. And any strange thing that comes to mind, it's not like you're embarrassing someone else. It's all on you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Look at that. He's such a nice gentleman.
So nice.
The Englishman without the English accent.
That's right. Yeah. The best kind of Englishman. Stealth Englishman.
That should be your tagline.
The best kind of Englishman? Or
no, the Englishman without being English. Or the English without the accent.
All that
you
matters,
said it. You just
none
said
of the
it.
Accent.
So while we have you here, we've been kind of chatting about this Fyre Festival, and that got Esmeralda thinking about an earlier story this week about some fancy pants.
Yeah, literally.
Quite.
$425 worth.
Right.
They're Nordstrom's was selling them, or I think they still are. Mm-hmm. They are jeans that look like they've been muddied.
I saw that.
You saw them?
With fake dirt.
Yeah, they got fake dirt on them.
Heavily distressed PRPS Barracuda straight leg jeans embody rugged Americana workwear that's seen some hard working action with a crackled, caked on muddy coating that shows you're not afraid to get down and dirty. So here's the thing.
From that dark time when your ancestors had jocks.
So I get jeans that are $100 or so. I wear jeans. I have like two pairs of jeans at a time, and I wear them every single day. And I kind of alternate or go 1 week on, 1 week off. It is great to have a good fitting pair of jeans, and I have no problem spending $100
on a pair. Because they're good quality.
The jeans I'm wearing now, I mean, I've probably worn these things 500 times. I mean, that's not an exaggeration. They were probably $80 to $120. But to pay $425 for any jean is a lot. And then one covered in crap is
crap.
Just go to Kohl's.
Artistic.
Get a $30 pair of jeans and go run around in the mud.
Yeah, but these have been artfully muddied.
What does that mean?
Hand muddied.
Yeah, they know
artisanal.
They're probably thinking of like, well, what could they have been doing?
Right.
And it hit them right at the thigh, then a little in the calf area.
This is exactly where the horse kicked him. Not quite right on the groin, but slightly to the left of the groin.
So I'm, and then I also saw that some a store from the UK actually called Topshop. They're selling.
Topshop.
They're selling clear.
Can we get a UK translation of Topshop, please?
Topshop.
Oh, there it is. Okay.
They're selling clear plastic jeans.
Clear plastic jeans.
And
these are a little more affordable, right? I think they were
right
around 110 or something like that.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by
55 pounds, which is probably like
about
70?
Yeah, right now 70 some bucks.
Might
I should
be less.
Know, but,
2 years ago, probably a little bit more. But,
a few years before that, even.
Mm-hmm.
And they look like jeans, except they're made of plastic and they're clear.
Now, I saw the internet just kind of poo-poo these things, and I was one of them, but you have a different take.
Well, I was looking at them like, oh, these are the worst, both of them. And then I was thinking, wait, what if you put jeans on under the clear plastic ones, and then because if you're a messy person, you spill on them, and then you just wipe them up.
So you
do like
it's the
movie.
It's
like
the grandma
it, I was just,
cover.
It's the pants poncho.
Can you put that in
there
English, please? Can we get a translation of pants poncho?
Well, it'd be trouser poncho because pants, you know.
Oh, yeah, pants are underwear.
Yeah.
It's a great way to get some giggles.
True. So basically, it's because you are a dirty person and you spill things all over
you.
Just for that moment, why don't you just put these over your normal jeans, though?
No, yeah, that's what you would do with the clear ones.
Oh, I thought
so
you would
be
just
like a grandma couch cover.
Okay. But the clear ones you just wear on your on their own too.
Well,
right?
I mean, yeah, you wear them on your own, but I'm not going to do that. That's insane.
Yeah,
I'm going to wear pants under them.
So I see what you're saying. So you really are doing the grandma couch thing.
Yes, pretty much. And then the dirty jeans, yeah, they're very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping that at one point there will be knockoffs, and then it'll be a whole thing. Like, it's cool to have dirty jeans. And then when people just buy those $30 jeans, they can have dirty jeans and it's fine. It's right. Like the ripped hole thing.
Yes, that happened like in the 90s, and then yeah. Suddenly everyone wanted their jeans to look like someone else had worn them.
Exactly. People buy very expensive ripped jeans, but you can just do it yourself, and you look stylish.
It's super easy.
Yeah.
My only, or not fear, I assume that when you wash the dirty jeans, they don't come out clean.
No, they stay. Yeah, it's just one
right,
wear.
That
one
be...
wear. Because it literally is not
really
just
authentic.
Dirt, which would be crazy.
But you could DIY your own.
You could, and you could make a lot of money doing it.
Oh, see? That 312-981-7200.
I do want to hear, speaking of the grandma couch thing, I want to hear, you know, we had listeners last week calling in that were in their 70s and their 80s. Mm-hmm. I want to hear from someone that has that plastic couch cover still and find out at what occasions does it actually come off? Because my grandmother had one. But then what is the point? Isn't there supposed to be a moment when the plastic comes off?
Wait
a minute. You mean the clear plastic?
Yes. Isn't it supposed to come off on fancy occasions?
Can I raise my hand?
Yes, Roger.
Oh, yes.
Yes, you can
clear
raise
plastic.
It. What about it?
I got it.
Okay, so when do you
on both our couches.
When do you take it off?
I don't.
Right? Because that's why it's clear.
Well, that's why it's clear. But we also put on, because we have a dog,
mm-hmm.
so we have a water-resistant cover over that covers the entire couch.
Isn't plastic water-resistant already?
Yeah, but it can tear. When he gets on there with his paws,
after
several people sit on the couch and get up and then sit down and get up, the plastic kind of moves a little bit.
Yeah.
So, and it's not really the thickest, firmest, most unbreakable piece of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
So it does tear sometimes.
So you have multiple layers.
I have multiple layers on the couch.
You know what I say?
What?
Roger, just get clear pants.
Yeah.
Everyone wears clear pants in your house. You don't have to cover the
couch. Wait, do I have to get clear pants for the dog?
Yes.
Okay. Just check it.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be too cute.
At this point, why not just get an old couch from the dumpster and cover it in trash bags? What's the point?
Actually, these are the couch and the love seat, the two-seater that we have,
mm-hmm.
my parents' furniture.
Okay.
Which we inherited.
Yeah.
And it's furniture that had plastic on it. Even when we first got it 50-some-odd years ago when we lived in Evanston.
But if you were to take off that plastic,
yes.
How nice does that look?
But
the couch looks beautiful.
Yeah,
after all these years.
This is what drives me crazy.
Not if the dog sat on it, though, and started biting its paw.
Well, then you put the plastic back
on. But if you're saving it for something, like you're trying to protect the couch to look nice for an occasion, there should be an occasion in which you take it off.
We don't do occasions in our house.
Yeah, but
maybe you're just never there for the occasion.
Yeah, maybe that's not inviting.
Yeah, that's true. I think the dog's having an occasion right now.
See, but you can see the beautiful couch through the clear plastic.
No, but then it's all crinkly and it reflects off the light. All right, we got Patrick from Rolling Meadows. Patrick, you want to chime in about these jeans?
Seriously, so any guy that is like myself that does construction, I buy my jeans for $20 at Meijer Levi's, and I'll sell them to you for $250.
See, you can make some money in this whole situation.
It, Patrick, I think you've stumbled on something here.
It's going to be your side gig.
I mean, seriously, who is the genius that came up with, like, ooh, we need to muddy pants for our exam? You know, I really think the person that has something to do with this is related to Rauner, because Rauner with his commercials, he's always wearing those plaid t-shirts.
Oh, right, he is. And the Carhartt jackets.
Really seriously. Oh, okay, yeah, you're a working guy. Really,
still
we
got
all
the
know
label
what
on
you
it.
Do.
Yeah.
It's like, really? I mean, sure.
He's got that duct tape, though, Patrick.
Oh,
come on.
Listen. Right. Listen, when you meet me, and when you meet anybody, would you not know who they are?
Immediately.
I mean, they can be wearing, I mean, seriously, you could be, seriously? You're where you spent. I want to punch you in the face for buying a pair of pants for $425 because they have mud smeared on them.
See, but if you make them, $250 in your pocket.
And Rod and Patrick, we appreciate the call, and you'll certainly make a little bit of money. But he's got a point. He could easily do that.
Oh,
and
no, I think it's real dumb.
Not only would they be muddy, but he could get them all weathered, too, like with all those tools and machines he uses. Anyways, we've got to take a quick commercial break. We're going to have more with Paul Harris after this here on 720 WGN.
I've been counting my blessings and everyone's a curse. It works, the pain has me wary of the poison in my veins. If this is love, then this is love, and I'd rather have it end. I forget, friends forgive, and then I alienate them. But I'm not sorry, I'll probably do it again. It's not quite nostalgia, sends me back all the same. It's anagrams unworthy and everyone spells out your name. If this is fate, then this is fate, and I won't be to blame for fighting every part of it. It's just the way I'm made. I'm not sorry, I will do this again. Oh, again. Down in the moor, I felt invincible. The drugs stem the tide, but I'm just so habitual. Down in the moor, we're swept up by the flood. Yeah, you were just someone. Yeah, you were just someone. Life lived in fear of weekends. We rack up our debt. You're too tired from your tap dance, so get yourself to bed. It's curtains for the earth, and it's forever for the dead. If all the world's a stage, I'm actually pretty glad you broke my legs. I'm not sorry, no. No, no, no. I'm not sorry, and I will do this again. Oh, again. Down in the moor, I was still miserable. You were quite flexible, if only in principle. Down in the moor, our addictions play like art. You broke my heart, yeah, you broke my heart. Over and over and over, and I'm over the worst of it now. Yeah, I'm over the worst. Or it's all in a verse somewhere. I left my sentiments smoldering. I was hoping you might like what I did with my hair. I don't know who I am, or why I waste every chance I get to be sincere. Down in the moor, it all got so visceral. My misery loved your company's visual. Down in the moor, we were out of control. Yeah, somehow I grew old. Yeah, somehow I grew old. But I'm not sorry, and I will probably do it again.
Oh, that was so good.
Yay.
Paul, you're really talented.
Aw, thanks, guys.
I know that sounds so silly to say, but your lyrics, you really can get lost in them. Not in a lost, I'm confused sort of way, but they really are approachable in a way.
Thank you.
And something very relatable about all that. Well, that was really good. What was that?
Yeah. Oh, no, go ahead.
That was called Down in the Moor.
Moor, not a word you hear too often here.
Not a thing that happens here.
Right. Yeah. What is a moor?
It's like a... Well, in England, if you're referring to any terrain, safe bet that it's muddy. but it's like a grassland type
thing. Swamp-ish?
Somewhere more, slightly more appealing than a swamp, you know?
It's like long grass, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, like long grass, stretching fields. Like lots of golf courses used to be moors.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Okay.
There we go.
Like
hilly,
the plains.
Too, I think. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like the plains. There you go. Not quite a bog.
Yeah, not quite. I'm a bog person. I'm from that part of the country.
There's a part of the country, the bog country?
Yeah, just where the mud gets pretty big or, you know, deep. Manchester.
Okay. The things I'm
the
learning.
Rural
can you
bits
fall
around.
In it?
Yeah. Or if you have a small dog, you can lose it.
Oh, no. Oh, wow.
We used to have a Cocker Spaniel, and she'd get up to, like, her neck in the mud and just kind of trudge through.
Make sure you're wearing your jeans.
That's right.
Right? Because then,
then you could resell them. Yeah, you had a good point, Paul, that you wanted to bring up.
Oh, right. Yeah, my question was, and it's basically, if you have a pair of those muddy jeans and I get mud on them, is that okay?
Right.
I would say no.
Right?
They're going to get real mad that you got mud on them.
You muddied my artfully dirty jeans.
Right. The person who's spending $425 would probably be upset by the mud on the muddy jeans. Just like the person who... I still cannot... I don't get the couch thing. I'm never going to get the couch thing.
To keep it looking nice.
We're going to have news here in a few seconds, but I wanted to hear 312-981-7200. Does anybody put a cover on their couch besides Roger Badish, and do you ever uncover it? Because what is the point if you don't ever uncover it? Because that's what I feel like it should be for special occasions. The cover comes off, and you say, look at how nice our couch is. And now, oh, we need to protect it again.
Yeah, but then someone will spill on it, and then there goes your couch.
You need to think of it like people who collect Star Wars figurines.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You keep them in the box.
Yeah, but you don't sit on them.
A different generational thing.
I just don't.
But you don't take them out of the box,
like,
ever.
You would never.
Yeah, you don't play with them.
That makes. Okay,
you never
that's...
put plastic wrap on your IKEA stuff, right? Because who cares? But
who
I feel
cares?
Like there's, for certain people, furniture used to be something more, maybe.
But, but to me, the plastic wrap brings it down a notch because it makes it look like, oh, yeah, it's covered in this plastic wrap. I feel like there should be, at special occasions, it should come out and it should be, like, in its fully functioning form. Without you having to crinkle on it when you sit on it and then all that stuff. And then, then you expose it to the elements. Let it breathe a little bit.
It's a lifestyle, John. It's a lifestyle.
I don't get it.
It's a lifestyle choice.
I certainly don't get it. Hey, Paul Harris, where can people find your music at?
You can find my music at paulharris.bandcamp.com or soundcloud.com/paul.
Just Google everything.
Yeah, Paul just Google Paul Harris. And, you know, it's a really rare name. There's I've never, you know, there's only about 3 billion of us.
Right. And you have, you got a couple digital albums on there for as low as $2. I could see downloading that entire thing and just listening to it on a long drive.
Do it.
Oh,
please.
For sure.
It's long drive, peaceful music.
I was going to say, do you have any, are you playing anywhere?
I have nothing coming up right now. I wish I did. Just finished a batch of songs, but those albums, they've got a bunch of songs on them. They're $2 because, being the industrious guy I am, I recorded them on my phone. I feel like lots of songs, it's a good trade-off.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. So paulharris.bandcamp.com. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. This was really cool.
Thank you so much.
You're
for
going
having me.
Places, young man. I sound like such an
old
person.
Guys are too kind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. And if you're an Amazon Echo user, just say, hey, play WGN Radio. I added the hey. You don't have to say hey. You don't have to say please. You just say play WGN Radio. WGN, John Hanson and Esmeralda Leon. The dancing, Esmeralda Leon. You got some moves this morning.
Blondie's going to be here in July.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Ravinia with Garbage.
Oh, that sounds like a blast.
It's going to be so good.
And we're filling in for Matt Bubala on this Saturday morning. 312-981-7200. The phone lines are open. We'd love to have you join the conversation. Really quickly out of news, Esmeralda, I wanted to mention this story. Roger, I'm surprised it wasn't in your news report, this one here.
Wow.
Critiquing
exactly. Already, Roger.
Yeah, I know. Welcome back. Now get on the ball here. The London Marathon started 5 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Tom Harrison is nearly done. It's not that he's a slow runner, it's that he's a slow crawler, particularly wearing his gorilla suit. The man dubbed Mr. Gorilla is raising money for the gorilla organization. So far, nearly $30,000 have been pledged. He's hoping to finish the race today this Saturday, with his two sons expected at the finish line to celebrate his feat, F-E-A-T. I'm sure his F-E-E-T will not be celebrated, perhaps bathed in ice. Okay, so he ran the marathon last year. He raised money for gorillas, but he finds crawling much more stressful. It's shoulders, hamstrings, glutes, quads, from the constant crouching. We're not really designed to do that. He says the money will be used to protect endangered gorillas in Africa. Congratulations, Tom Harrison. Crawling along on your hind legs and all four legs. I guess, yeah, all four. In a gorilla suit for 5 days.
How does that marathon go for 5 days?
It doesn't. He's just
going for five days.
I'm sure they've reopened the roads.
Yeah, but I'm like, are you in the middle of the road blocking traffic, or did you move to the sidewalk?
That'd be a good political statement.
He's following the bananas down the middle of the road.
Oh, he's like Donkey Kong.
Yeah, there you go.
I cannot think of a cause that I care that much about.
To
that
crawl.
To do anything for 5 days. Anything.
I would do one of those. You know how they do the cancer walks, which is like 3 days?
Yeah.
I would do that. Be neat.
Yeah.
I mean, I would do it on like my 2 feet.
Yeah. They do 39 miles. I think, I forget who does that, but I know what you're talking about. A long walk.
Yeah, that would be nice. I wouldn't crawl. And why is he crawling?
Because he's doing it like a gorilla here.
Yeah, but gorillas kind of, they drag their arms.
Yeah, maybe they're just saying crawling because it's the closest thing to what he's doing.
Well, I don't know if he's gorillas do walk
right
using their arms.
Although it'd be really hard to do that because he would be, if he was going
to be
like,
bent over.
Exactly.
Kind of weird. Kind of.
Well, here's the picture, Esmeralda.
Exactly.
You can kind of see him doing it, you know?
Oh, he is doing it.
He's
like
doing
a gorilla.
He's doing it like a gorilla.
Oh, that's got to be painful.
26.2 miles.
Wow.
He's like,
when did they start? 5 days ago?
5 days ago. That was when this article was published, which was.
Well,
it doesn't have a
race
date here.
Start?
Yeah. Does he have a mask on?
He has a top.
Did he lift up? Because I can see his face,
looks,
but did he
yeah,
have a
it,
face?
It looks like
did he
he's
look a gorilla.
Does he have
up?
A face? Yes, he's got.
No, but you know, like the gorilla mask.
Oh, the gorilla.
Yeah,
like
he's lifted
thing.
Up. He's lifted up part of the mask.
Oh, okay. That's got to be weird. You're just walking, going to work, and
but that's dedication. And look, here's the thing about this: he's going to finish this race, which is great for him. Raised a lot of money for gorillas, which is a good cause. But it's not like they're going to say thank you. It's not even a cause that they appreciate.
That's not really
I know
what
that's
you
not
do
the
things for, John.
I know, but like, you don't even get to see like the satisfaction. Like if you were to hand deliver that 40 grand, whatever he
what
ends up with, to the gorillas,
about?
They would just probably
well,
beat the
what
crap out
of them. What
did
a gorilla do with 40 grand?
Yeah.
Come on, John.
You're not giving
big
it
party,
to the
baby.
Darn gorillas.
Big party down in Gorilla Land. I'm
all the bananas
you.
They
the party
buy.
Of the Planet
bananas,
of the Apes.
Yeah.
That's a fair point.
Cut fair... that guy off. He's had too many bananas.
They're buying banana liqueur.
Oh,
banana
I guess it's a
beer.
Fair point. He's not bringing them cash. I get that. He's helping preserve the species.
They're probably
going
to build something in his name.
What are they going to build?
I don't know. Some sort of jungle gym situation for the gorillas.
What's
what?
His name?
They live in the jungle.
What's his
they
name
don't
again?
Need a
Jim?
Gym.
No,
his
I'm
name
sorry.
Is Tom Harrison.
Oh, Tom.
The Tom Harrison Ape Village.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Why not?
$40,000 will go a long way.
Yeah.
Now, I just cannot think of a cause that I am that passionate about that I would sacrifice. And maybe this says more about me than anything else that I would sacrifice because he probably had to use vacation time for this. You don't get to call
I love
in
that
sick.
That's your worry.
You don't get. Like,
oh, my
you're
PTO.
Using, yeah, you're, it's going to really do
yeah, what's
drain.
The rental on the costume, though? Seriously.
Yeah. He should
that's
have just bought
point,
it.
That's a fair point, Roger.
At that you know. Point, you just buy it.
Yeah, exactly. Because who's going
to
take that
I got this thing for 7 days, and I'm using every second of it.
Right?
Well,
like
what'd you do in the costume? It shows a little wear. I crawled for 26 miles.
What's the, I wonder what were the breaks? Did he take breaks?
Right.
Did he sleep?
Yeah. He had to. Gorilla
was he
sleep,
sleeping
right?
on the sidewalk?
Gorilla's got to sleep, so he's got.
So he's in a tree somewhere?
He just has a pile of leaves.
In the middle of the business district?
Yeah, what is he eating, too, other than the bananas?
He's got, I don't know, that's probably
sure
like tree stalks.
Trail mix.
You know.
This article is shockingly too short to answer these
yeah,
questions.
It's lacking detail.
It certainly
right.
is.
You need
it,
to send me over there so I can really report the details.
There you go.
See, that's why, Roger, you didn't report this.
I
you,
it wasn't
the details
enough.
Were not flushed out.
Yeah.
It was not. But no,
get
I,
him on the phone.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's got a cell phone in a
in his
pocket
exactly.
somewhere.
Right. 312-981-7200, is there a cause that you would do something like this for?
Seriously, that's a very good question, though.
I don't know if I would to his extent.
Yeah, because, I mean, this, I mean, you got to, and I'm not, and I know it's a joke, but you got to take off the time for work. You've got to, you know, you don't see your family, I assume.
They can, he's not like, it's not like he's in the jungles with the gorillas. He's crawling down the street. It's London, right?
Yeah, but do you think his wife's going to join him?
I mean, she'll probably walk with him.
No, she's
for
not.
For a little bit. Be like, I have to go to the store, so I went this way
just
instead.
Just walking next to your husband. Yeah, exactly.
Holding the bananas.
On her errand, yeah. No,
yeah,
exactly.
I brought you some bananas.
His two sons are expected at the finish line to celebrate it, so they're not joining in. They're just, they're like, and what do you tell your kids are probably like, oh, what's your dad doing this week? Well, he's put on a gorilla suit, and he's walking, he's crawling 26.2 miles. He's
crawling for gorillas.
Yeah.
And by the way, you know, if you're going to do that, you better raise more than $30,000. I'm also just saying that.
That's a lot of money.
But the
for
guy is crawling 26 miles, Roger. That's only $1,000 per mile.
Is that pounds?
No, I did the conversion in my head.
Oh, okay.
It's 22,000 pounds. So that's about 28.5, according to, well, in my head, by that I mean I did it in Google, but.
I wonder if you wore knee pads or anything.
Yeah. And then what do you do next year to top this off? And what other cause, because you ran it last year.
You get your fellow gorilla lovers to go with you.
And you get a whole little group of gorillas?
Yeah, a whole pod of gorillas.
You could do something for the crabs.
Ponds? I don't know if they're called ponds. For the crabs?
Yeah. Yeah, and then crab walks the whole
way. And then the coup de grace is going to be...
Save the snakes.
Save the snakes. Just slither along the streets of London.
Ooh, he does that dance. He does the snake the whole way.
This guy's got to be unemployed. this is so much time to give
up. Is it really the gorillas, a.k.a. his family? Is that what this is for?
Right. Am I this cynical that I just would not a week of my... Would you give a week of your time for this? Something, for anything? I just cannot fathom.
Well, one, he's famous sort of now.
Sort of.
He's getting talked about. Mm-hmm. He's in the news. And he did a good deed.
Say his name. It's just Mr. Gorilla.
He's what?
Hi, my business card.
I'm Mr. Gorilla.
Mr. Gorilla.
You may know me. I crawled the marathon for
gorillas.
Kind
of famous. Raised a lot of money. But what would you do?
I don't know.
For what cause that you would feel deeply enough to want to do that?
I guess I got to pick a cause that I feel anything about first. I guess that's a problem.
But also, what would you do? Because you could pick whatever and then give them the money.
How would you raise that money?
And
no GoFundMe pages.
Right. I have a lot of passion for, you know, LGBT youth. I think that's important.
Okay.
So I don't know. I'll strut down. I'll do a marathon and
strut?
Throw glitter everywhere.
That'll be your walk.
I know that's stereotypical, but something. I got to figure out some LGBT.
In heels.
That is something. But that you would do quicker than in a week, obviously.
But you would start at one point. I mean, 26 miles
blisters.
And heels.
Oh, yeah. Blisters and corns.
I would do that, but that'd be probably 2 days.
You know what you would do? So you would have, get a sponsor from a shoe company, and you would walk, a mile in one pair.
Mm-hmm.
Then you would autograph them and auction them and raise money that way.
I like it.
And so how many? 26 miles,
26
right?
26 miles, yeah.
So 26 pairs of shoes, auction them off.
All right. Hey, can you coordinate all that for me, Roger?
Yeah. Let me get right on it.
All right. We got to take a quick commercial break here on 720 WGN. WGN. I was just thinking, Esmeralda, I don't even think I'd do the gorilla walk around the studio.
What?
Like,
come
that'd
on.
Be hard.
Oh,
should
I
try
see.
It? I mean,
are your arms long enough?
I don't know.
Hold learned on, today second. I have short arms.
You might want to go to the live stream for this, WGNradio.com.
Right. I'm going to run around the studio.
All right, hold on. I'm going to talk through this. All right, so you put your legs are to walk like a gorilla.
So you got to crouch.
You got to crouch down, okay, like this?
No.
No.
Because they're bent.
They're bent?
I think.
They bend their knees?
I think so.
Aren't their legs kind of straight, the gorillas, their back legs?
Yeah, but
legs?
They have...
Hold on.
I mean, they have...
I'm going to take off my headphones here.
I want to say their knees are bent. Because they have knees, right?
Yeah. Yes, gorillas have knees.
Hey! Yes.
There it is.
There it is. It's just I think your butt may need to, no, their butts go up in the air.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
Their butts stick out.
You got to really dig into your primal instincts.
Right.
You know,
and then
I
think
really
it's
feel it.
it's the arms. Their arms are much longer.
I
and
did
then
about
they do kind of like this
a shimmy.
They do. They kind of like wiggle. They do like a skip of some sort.
I did 4 steps of that and I'm
is
exhausted.
It
was painful. He's got to have some sort of gloves on too, because you're.
I think he just had on the whatever mitts
the
they
rental.
Give you for the rental. Yeah.
That was a legit question from Roger, by the way.
I would hope he would put stuff on under the gorilla suit, like knee pads,
yeah.
and
boy,
you know,
that'd
just
be
gloves and stuff. Mm-hmm.
I give him credit. I just think he's. Yeah. I just wouldn't do it.
So I took him 5 days.
312-981-7200. John Hansen and Esmeralda Leon mm-hmm. filling in for Matt
Bubala.
And you sent me this one, Esmeralda, about moldy bread. How'd you get on this?
Well, one, because I come from a family that does not, if there's mold on something, it's fine. Just cut it off.
Right.
It's still good.
Same here.
It's still good.
You could see the mold. Mold
right.
doesn't represent, or I didn't think so at least, anything terrible. Mold is a naturally occurring thing. We eat mold all the time. Cheese
exactly.
is essentially
cheese,
mold.
Penicillin.
Exactly. It's all mold. So, you know, you don't want the green stuff, just cut it off and eat the rest of it.
Yeah.
Apparently that's not good.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I read this. I saw this article. I was like, oh, no.
Mm-hmm.
That, no.
But, so what's bad about it? Because I figured
well,
that you
one,
were...
it's mold.
Well, but if you're cutting off the mold.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it gets into everything.
The mold spreads.
Right. It's not just in that little localized part.
But I assume that if it wasn't green, you were good to go.
If it what? If it
like,
wasn't
If it wasn't green?
Green.
Like if you just cut it off, that maybe, okay, maybe a few
mold. Oh, the other parts?
Yeah, maybe some moldy sporcels had gotten over there. But
yeah.
But you're in generally
I mean, they
in
do.
Good shape.
Well, it's also a thing of people who eat moldy foods suffer allergic reactions and they get respiratory problems. Because you are,
really?
Because the mold is there, you're inhaling it. That can't be good, even if it's a small little bit. You still shouldn't be inhaling mold.
I mean, I have taken, sometimes Brett and I will make bread,
mm-hmm.
and that can get pretty moldy because we don't put preservatives, you know, we just make it at home.
Right, you have to eat it real fast.
Yeah, we eat it really fast. There's been times I've gone a couple days, and I mean, I'm talking, this thing is covered in mold.
Yeah,
and I literally get a spoon out. And I just spoon out the moldy parts, and it's like half the thing,
yeah,
and
so,
I just kind of eat the rest. So I'm in trouble.
Yeah, soft foods, they're soft. Bread is soft food. The roots of the mold,
mm-hmm.
or the tentacles.
The tentacles.
As this person put it, mm-hmm. Gets deeper into the food, so you're eating mold.
So I've eaten a lot
Either
of mold.
Either way, you've
so
been eating a lot of
what,
mold.
What happens? What's the bad
well,
thing?
Well, it just not good for you. It just makes it, one, again, it's the whole allergies thing because you're inhaling it. It could be because, so it's in the roots, right? It's
right.
going into all the roots. Just because you don't see it doesn't mean you're not inhaling it.
Okay.
So as you're eating that thing, you're getting all this bad stuff. But also, it's mold. It's not good for your tummy.
It builds character. What are you talking about?
I mean, yeah. I'm one to eat mold.
It says
I don't eat the mold, but I'm like you, John, where I cut it off
yeah.
and just eat it.
It says here you can make an exception if your loaf has already been sliced.
Mm.
While mold can absolutely jump from one piece of bread to another, other more terrible bacteria may have already claimed primary real estate on your food. If you think that one side of the loaf hasn't been affected, you can take the calculated risk.
And I always do.
Oh, absolutely.
I
that is a
do.
Risk worth
now,
taking.
Now, do you do this? You do this for a lot of foods? Because I do it too.
Cheese, absolutely.
Yeah. What about the sell-by dates? That's a huge thing where people freak out.
Oh, no.
I know people who are like, no, I throw it out. It's sell-by
date. No.
Yeah, because the date on there. And it's like, no, that's not
a sell-by date.
Exactly.
You've got more time on the eat-by date.
Exactly.
Or the drink-by date.
Yes.
I mean, honestly, with milk, all I do with it, because I'll keep it a lot longer. I buy a gallon of milk. I don't go through it very fast because I just use it in my coffee and maybe in a bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch if I'm really being terrible on my diet. I'll have some of that. And I do the smell test. With milk.
Absolutely. And then, and you were talking about, I do this too, sometimes the smell test might be a little...
Even a little.
But then I'm like, is that just me thinking? Is that just right. my head, or is it okay?
I will still keep sour milk even when it's a little sour.
That's buttermilk.
When it starts to chunk up is where we get into problems. That's no good.
It's not cottage
but
cheese.
But no, I just had, and this has just happened to me, I just tossed milk today, and I still felt bad doing it, even as it was clumping out of the gallon thing.
No, I feel the same
about
way.
About 12 days after, but I had used it up until about day 10 after the sell-by date.
Yeah. Now, what about food you make?
Food that I make.
I get real lax on that.
You mean you'll keep it for weeks?
I'll go a week. A few more days. You know, I just depending. If there's mold, then I'm out.
Oh, mold, I'm done. I mean, if it's in Tupperware and it's a harder food, gone.
Soups and I'll smell it. I'm like,
oh, yeah.
I think this is okay.
Here's what I'll say.
And I cautiously eat it.
Exactly. I will lean on the side of, meh, I'll try it.
Right. And then I'm like, well, I'll just stick around my house for a few hours. And if nothing happens, then I'm okay.
Is that what happened that one day when you came into work? Anyways.
No, I don't know what that was.
Okay.
That was almost a fluke.
You almost didn't make it. 312-91-7200. Do you eat moldy stuff? Do you use the smell test? Are you generally cautious? Or do you let it go? Just say, hey, I'll give it a shot.
Yeah, I do that. I do stuff. So like if I make a big soup. Mm-hmm. I'll let it sit out for the night to cool because you're not supposed to put it in so hot. And then sometimes I have to come to work. So then it's out overnight. But, you know, the lid's on it.
But what you're supposed to do then.
People are like, you're supposed to put it in because then like bacteria forms. But if you reheat it, it's fine. But then there's just dead bacteria in your soup. And I'm like, well, it's fine.
It's dead. That's another thing, too. When people are like, oh, did you wash your hands before you started cooking that meat? I'm like, oh, maybe. I don't know. But I'm going to cook the meat.
One thing that, so my boyfriend.
Is this gross? I don't know. Sorry.
Well, kind of. What were you doing with your hands before?
Nothing terrible. I mean, I just general hand things.
Nothing terrible.
I wasn't crawling a marathon, I'll tell you that much.
No, what my boyfriend did, and I got so mad about it, was we were making food, and we were cooking, we cooked some sort of raw meat, and we sauteed it, and then he was going to grab another spoon for a different thing. To use that. And I'm like, what are you doing? Just use that same one. And he goes, no, it was touching this meat. I'm like, yeah, but you cooked it. It's fine. He's like, no, it's cross-contamination. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Wait, the spoon touched the cooked meat?
Yes.
Well, then who cares?
Right?
If it's touched the cooked meat, then it doesn't
matter.
I'm
like, you are insane.
No.
And he's like, I just took a class.
Yeah.
It's cross-contamination. I'm like, it's fine. This is my house.
We got to take a quick commercial break, but we'll get Roger's thoughts on moldy bread after this on 720 WGN.
Jen Michaels on WGNplus.com.
I'm Spiritual Dammit is different conversations with authors in the spiritual space, self-help, woo-woo, paranormal, basically everything that pushes the envelope that people want to talk about, but they're kind of afraid to talk about. I'm Spiritual Dammit is best-selling authors that think outside the box about spirituality, self-help, and everything else that's going on. You can find I'm Spiritual Dammit at WGNplus.com. We have new podcasts every week, so check it out for a new conversation.
720 WGN, John Hanson, Esmeralda Leon filling in for Matt Bubala on this Saturday morning. Rogers just alerted us that he can't see us.
I can barely see
you. Can you hear us?
I can hear you.
You're lucky because we've just even turned on more lights down here.
Really? I see this one huge lamp in the middle camera.
Yeah, it's mood lighting, Roger.
Could you see Patty in them or no?
No, I couldn't see him at all except for Patty in the middle camera where the lamp is that you're touching.
Right.
Mood lighting.
Right. We got mood lighting in here. It's much
mood
too
lighting?
Bright.
Yeah, nude lighting. We're all naked down here.
Oh, no wonder I can't see anything.
Exactly.
Yeah, we've done that.
Blinded by the light.
Roger, will you, if you got mold on your bread, do you cut it off and eat the rest of it?
No, throw it out.
The whole thing?
Yeah.
Why?
Toss the whole thing.
Well, you're doing it right. I mean, that's what we've just learned.
Yeah, you're not supposed to.
What about cheese?
But still.
Cheese, same thing. In fact, I found some the other day but you know what? Never mind. Don't get me started. Because I also do the grocery shopping, and I cannot stand the packaging that it's like you got to feed an army of people with the kinds of packaging they have for food, especially when you're either living by yourself or it's just two of you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our son lives with us, but he buys his own food and uses his own food.
Right.
And the stuff that when we buy something, it's not in the right portion.
Be a real American and eat all of it, Roger.
Yeah. No,
but then I wouldn't be able to get into the car to drive here.
Hey,
that's the
American way. Exactly. Yeah, we're going to keep you at home as long as you can. By the way, we have some extra lighting in here. We got some mood police blue flashing lights.
Yeah, flashing lights.
Now we're having a party.
Yeah, we got someone might be in a little bit of trouble
Tell
them
the flashing's got to be a little faster. You need the strobe to really work there so I can like see you guys moving like a robot.
Yeah, we'll communicate that over to the police right away, Roger. All right, it's 3:31 here on WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com. WGN, John Hanson and Esmeralda filling in for, what was that?
I said hello.
Hello. These bright blue lights are kind of tripping me out a little bit here. We've got someone pulled over here on Michigan Avenue in the northbound lane.
Someone's
in trouble. I mean, like directly in front of the Allstate Showcase studio. And since our lights are already dimmed in here.
Oh,
and
now
we even...
it's just one light.
Oh, now it's
weird.
Just one.
I think his lights went out.
He flashed them for
his
too long.
His flashy lights. Now it's just one.
Yeah, okay. Maybe it's not quite an emergency. The back ones look like they're still going.
Right.
Maybe he's listening to 720 and
that's
just heard
a sign.
Us. Hello, officer. How are you doing today?
Flash them all again if you're listening.
I think he's giving us a thumbs up, actually.
That's the equivalent? Okay.
I don't know. I think he might be busy, but we appreciate that.
He's doing his job. I think it's working.
Oh, then the guy's no longer pulled over. That was easy.
Okay, bye.
Hey, good for him. All right, this one's wrapped on up. This mystery's wrapped up, everybody.
Dragnet.
There we go.
We got a text. Mom used the spoon on my butt when I bugged her when she was cooking, and she kept right on stirring whatever. And then he says, he or she says, the 847, cross-contamination, my... we can say that word, right? The A word? My butt.
Yeah.
I'll just say cross-contamination, my butt.
Yeah,
quite
see?
Literally.
And he's fine.
Mm-hmm.
He's still living.
Yeah, he's still doing. He's still texting the show. He's feeling alive.
I've got a question
regarding
this. When you're making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich,
okay.
Do you use the same knife to scoop out the peanut butter and then the jelly, or the jelly and then the peanut butter?
So I take the peanut butter and I scoop that first. For some reason, I feel like I should start with jelly, but I start with peanut butter. I then lick off the knife and then drop it right into the jelly and spread that everywhere.
Oh, that's a whole other. I was going to say, I don't eat peanut butter and jelly, but if I were to, I probably would. I would. You would do either, but make sure it's clean. Just because, and not thinking of like health reasons, just because what if I want to use that jelly for something else and then there's peanut butter in it?
What else are you going to use
jelly
for?
Or the other way around.
What else are you
going to
use
know.
Jelly for? No.
You could.
Toast?
No. You only use those things pretty much for PBJ. You can cross contaminate them.
You could make a lovely sauce.
With jelly?
Probably.
You
could
make
know.
Meatballs, you know, like sweet and sour meatballs.
Yeah, see?
Roger, would you use different knives or the same knife?
Having done this before, I would. Use whatever condiment I was using first, peanut butter or the jelly.
Mm-hmm.
I would spread it on one slice of bread.
Okay.
And then take the knife and make sure that I wipe it off completely on the second piece of bread.
Okay. Ah, yeah.
And then dip it in
that
the other
sense.
Condiment
mm-hmm.
and put it on that second slice.
Roger.
Genius.
I'm older than you. I've been around.
Mind blown. That's pretty good. 312-981-7200. What do you do with your peanut butter and jelly sandwiches? Give us a call or text us.
Yeah,
right. With the lights down low in the control room.
Hey, Esmeralda, we didn't talk about this during the break, but it's an interesting conversation that I was having with a couple friends this evening or late last night, or we were watching the Cubs game. And we were just talking about the colleges we ended up choosing to go to and how we made those choices. And I know a lot of high school seniors are making those choices now. And people are worrying about it. And we got to talking, and I had a lot of different schools that I wanted to choose from, which is not to brag. Literally, my mom did all the work for me. I got to admit this. She was so big on trying to get me to apply to as many colleges. She did this is so embarrassing to say, but she was so gung-ho about it that I was like, well, you do it if you really want me to go to all these schools. Like, but she wanted me to choose all these places. I would do the essays, but she would like fill out the applications. She was a saint. Having said that, also my second semester senior year of high school, I was doing like 9 musicals and plays and all that stuff, which is no excuse. Like looking back, I should have done this on my own. I visited no colleges after my mom went through all that work, got all these acceptances. I just picked the U of I because my friends were going there and they gave me a scholarship.
Wow.
So I was like, all right, sure.
All that
going
work.
To U of I. And it worked out great. I loved it. It was a wonderful school. But I mean, I turned down Mizzou offered me a little bit to go to their journalism school. I was like, I'm not going to do journalism, and here I am. Indiana University gave me a little money too. And again, this is, I guess this sounds a little braggy. It's not meant to be. This sparked the conversation of how different would my life be if I had just made, and that's a big decision, choosing which college to go to. But what are those like decisions you make in your lifetime that have completely altered the course of your history? You would not be maybe with the person that you're with right now. You would not be living in the place you're living in, the career. And obviously those sometimes come down to big decisions, but a lot of times these things come to very small decisions. When I was at U of I after I made the decision, I'll never forget, I took a different route to a class and I saw a flyer for a comedy group in town that I saw the flyer for, went and auditioned for, made the group, split off from that group with some other guys, formed a new group, but it became such a big part of my life and really brought me out of my shell that I would absolutely not be the person I am today had I not taken that different route to class that day. And it just, it really got us talking about those small decisions that you made that have made big impacts on your life. And I don't know if either of you guys have one, but it's fascinating to think of the road not traveled, I guess you could say.
Right. I guess I could say with my current boyfriend, we met at a comedy show, and it was a thing of, I was kind of like, I don't know if I want to go to this. It was the day before Halloween, and I was like, and then I was like, you know what? No, I'm going. And then I had a friend. I was like, come on, we're going to this thing. We're going to do it. Because I would never go to anything, to any of the comedy shows that they would ever put on. And then I went there and I met him.
Nice.
I met my boyfriend there.
That's a good one.
And I don't know him in the least, but we have a lot of connections Facebook-wise. We know people, but we've never met.
That's a good one.
Prior to that.
312-981-7200. Is there a turn of screw moment in your life, a seemingly small decision or something that happened that led to something very big in the long run, and you can't imagine life without it? My friends and I were talking, and one thing that my friend had said that he's a little bit bigger, but he used to be even bigger, and he said he got home one day, he bent over to tie his shoe, and one of his buttons popped off on his shirt. And he decided right then and there, he was just so fed up with it. Now, maybe that would have, a decision maybe would have come later on.
Right.
But it was that moment that he was like, okay, it's because of that button, I've got to kind of get things in order. I think he lost about 100 pounds over the next couple of years, which is great.
Good for him.
So I imagine there's always these little turns of things again that, and there's natural twists of fate throughout life that happen.
Yes.
But something that, like, where you can kind of walk back your life and find some sort of moment where everything kind of turned one way or the other, as a hush falls over the crowd. Tom, I don't know if you've got one.
Yeah. I mean, kind of following with Esmeralda's one, I would not be dating my girlfriend right now if I hadn't gone to a poker game in some dorm by accident,
really?
More or less. Yeah, I went to Loyola in Rogers Park, and when I first started college, you know, a little bit shy, a little bit jittery, all that kind of stuff, and I just happened to be walking around, and I saw my roommate, and I was like, oh, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to this random poker game. Do you just want to come? Yeah, sure, why not? And I go in, I sit down, turn to my right, and there she is sitting right there.
Wow.
And I was like, wow, she's got beautiful red hair.
I was gonna say, what are you about to say?
No,
right?
Yeah. No, it was very classically romantic. And then she looks at me and she's just like, oh, he's got cute ears. I like him.
Wow. All right.
I've heard the story before. Someone who, his wife had left her phone on the counter. And he thought he would do something nice and help her figure out that the battery draining problem that she always complains about, he was going to dig into her phone and help out.
Yeah.
And he discovered a few photos on her phone that she had sent to other people. And now they are obviously ex-husband and wife, which is a fascinating thing. And that story just came to my mind from someone that obviously life changed out a lot differently. But he's happy that he looked at this point. And he claims that that's what he was doing, the battery draining thing. I don't know if there were some trust issues or something like that. By the way, a text from the 708. I'm so glad I don't live with or eat anything you guys make. mold, throw it out. That's
I make
fair.
Delicious food.
Yeah, we
You're
do.
You're missing out.
It's not safe, but it tastes really, really
you
good.
You might get a little bit of something, but it's okay. It was worth it.
More John and Esmeralda coming up on 720. Oh, by the way, again, 312-981-7200. We want to hear from you. Turn of screw moments that changed your whole life on 720 WGN. Sweet dreams are made of the 720 WGN. That's a Eurythmics, right?
Yes.
John Hanson and the wonderful
ding, ding, ding.
The sound effect queen, Esmeralda Leon. You're almost like the guy from Police Academy.
Michael Winslow.
Yeah.
I only know that because I looked it up a few days ago.
Just because? Because
I was doing sound effects on air, and I wanted to reference him, and I couldn't remember his name.
312-981-7200, talking about some turn-of-the-screw moments in your life that have changed everything. We'll table that for a second, but I would like to mention, you know how Back to the Future 2, that's the one that came out in 89, and they predicted what would happen in 2015. And while we're a few years past that, slowly but surely these predictions are coming true. Obviously, the Cubs,
yeah, the Cubs
winning
won
the World Series.
They got those sneakers.
The hoverboards aren't quite there, but
they're getting there.
But the one that everyone always talks about and always kind of bemoans is the fact that we don't have
flying cars.
Flying cars, right?
I was waiting in 2000 for them.
You thought it'd be that early?
Well, because, you know, in the year 2000, it was a big thing and then nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing really did come about in 2000.
No.
Except, you know, the PC and stuff like that.
And other
giant technology,
you know,
technological
the
advances.
The iPod, yeah, you know, introduced thousands of songs.
Right, but it wasn't good enough for Esmeralda.
No.
She wanted her flying car.
Flying car.
Well, Uber is more than fly curious, which is a play on buy curious. Which I didn't get till right now when I was reading that. They are fly curious about taking ride sharing into the air. So the company announced this week that it plans to roll out a network of flying cars in Dallas-Fort Worth and Dubai by 2020.
Why in Dallas?
Yeah.
Is it because it's all open air?
I don't know. Maybe do they have a headquarters down there?
Oh, maybe.
Is it flat? I don't know. Why? Yeah, why Dallas? That's interesting. They're a big hub for airplanes. I don't know. Okay. If that sounds ambitious, because 2020 is not that long from now.
Right? 3 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Obviously, if that sounds ambitious, you aren't wrong. The kind of aircraft that Uber envisions shuttling customers through the air would be electric. It would have vertical takeoff and landing capability, and it could fly 100 miles in just 40 minutes. It's pretty quick. You're shaking your head.
I don't know. I mean, you know, we live in a world of pretty quick advancement and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, Elon Musk, the man from space, is like doing his own thing with Tesla. He's trying to privatize space travel. So I guess it's not completely out of the realm of possibility.
It seems quick for 2020.
Right. That's the big thing. It seems really quick.
Not only the cars themselves, but the infrastructure to support that. The allowing of planes to do this. We're just getting somewhere with drones now and the FAA and requiring people to be able to do this.
Right. I mean, how far up would they go?
I don't know.
In the air, would they bother planes?
Right.
Because planes have their own trajectories and all that. I mean, they have their own highways up there.
Mm-hmm.
Would this be on that same level?
I don't know. So instead of cracking these problems on its own, Uber plans to punt. It hopes to play the role of a catalyst. They want to spur manufacturers to build the aircraft. So they're kind of putting literally the flying cart before the stationary horse or something. I didn't make that work out too well.
But you
know what I'm saying. And that they'll figure out the regulations later. And I think that is interesting and smart because once people see that these cars can work and they exist, I imagine the demand will be through the roof. I mean, 100 miles in 40 minutes.
How far would that be from here, say?
That's almost to Urbana-Champaign. That's what I was thinking. It takes me 2 hours to get down there to go back and forth between Brett's place and here. But to do 100 miles would get me almost down there, certainly to Kankakee. So let's say Kankakee to Chicago.
I wonder how you could fly. Like, what would be? Would it be gas? Are we
it's electric.
It's
electric.
It's electric. Woogie, woogie, woogie.
Yeah. So here's the crazy part, and this is all from Wired.com. Uber could make it happen. They say that the director of flight research at an aeronautical university says that 2020 is realistic for a vehicle that is not replacing an airplane, but replacing a car. A purely electric aircraft might remain elusive, but a serial hybrid setup where the aircraft carries a fuel-burning turbine to help the juice flowing, much like the Volt, could work. So at its Uber Elevate Summit on this week, the company announced a series of partnerships to start figuring it out. So they've got real estate properties involved to be vertiports to get those built. That would be the infrastructure. ChargePoint, which operates electric vehicle hubs all over the country and all over the continent, they developed the infrastructure to keep them charged up.
Mm-hmm.
And the company estimated it would need about 1,000 aircraft to kind of get this thing going in 3 or 4 cities. And I just, you know, safety, of course, is a concern. I have Uber drivers, and I think we, you know, no fault to the Uber drivers necessarily themselves, who can't figure out how to get on Lakeshore Drive.
Right.
I worry about that. Uber drivers have not figured out Lower Wacker yet.
I haven't figured out Lower Wacker, to be fair.
But this isn't people driving. This isn't people Ubering you around. This will be my vehicle, and I will take it from here to there.
I guess.
And drive myself.
No, I don't think so. I think
so. So there's going to be people driving
it's
you
Uber,
around?
Yeah. So this wouldn't be personal vehicles. It's no surprise that Uber wants to have a fleet. They want to have a fleet of cars at some point.
Okay. Because I was thinking that they're wanting to move on.
No.
They're going to keep this on the ground and then be like, oh, but you can fly to wherever.
Yeah.
And here's a car to
You don't. Yeah. They'll still, I think someone will fly this thing, I imagine.
Do you think they'll only do long distances? Like, you can't just, you know, you're not just going to fly a few blocks to the bar, but like, you know, but if you need to get from the suburbs.
That would be incredible.
How quick would we get home? That'd
be
the best.
We'd be home so fast.
You'd be there before
the
pizza
village.
Guy.
Yeah, exactly. Which is good because I've notoriously done that. Ordered a pizza in the cab and gotten there after the pizza.
I want the pizza man to drive me, like in the commercials.
This just happened a couple months ago. I was very not in a good state of mind leaving the bar. Ordered a pizza, thought I would definitely not beat it home. Actually, I ordered the pizza still at the bar, which is always a problem. Had another drink and then got in my cab.
How far were you?
On the north side down to Ukrainian Village. So it's a good 25-minute drive. But, I mean, sometimes this place takes an hour and a half for pizza. I thought it would do the same thing. It didn't. And my buzzer's broken, so they have to call my phone. He calls me. I'm still about 2 miles away.
Mm.
And I'm like, please, I want this mac and cheese pizza. Please stay. He's like, man, I cannot. I mean, like, I will give you a $20 bill.
Did you pay by card?
I did pay by card. But
you should be like, just leave it on the porch.
Oh, I don't trust my neighborhood, and there was no chance I was going to lose it.
Someone's going to take your pizza.
Someone might take my pizza. So I went ahead and offered him $20 to just stay there with my pizza. Best decision I ever made.
I mean, okay.
I didn't feel that way the next day. But,
right. Mm-hmm. Although you had pizza to deal with the pain.
Mm-hmm.
This whole Uber car thing, I think it's fine. It's exciting.
You're fine with the flying cars?
Yeah, it's exciting. I mean, you know, they're not just going to willy-nilly start flying cars everywhere.
Right.
They're going to figure it out and how to do it right, hopefully.
Yeah, and I think that what their long-term goals are, and I think is that, you know, these days with the deregulation of the airlines, mm-hmm. we have so much centralization of airlines at the major hubs that, you know, flying from, let's say, Chicago to Nashville or Louisville or Columbus, some of the shorter flights, it's almost not even worth it now. You might as well just drive, and that's what a lot of people are doing.
Yeah.
Which certainly isn't good for our carbon footprints, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I welcome my robot overlords.
312-981-7200. Would you get into an Uber flight? Would you?
Because they're not people-less.
Right, no.
It's not like the driverless cars.
The autonomous, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, people are freaking out about that.
Bill wants to jump in here on the conversation. Bill, you're on 720 WGN. What do you think about this? The Uber flying cars?
Well, everybody's wondering, you know, how are we going to have flying? You only have one flying car out there yet. We don't have one that I know of. And yet they're going to have a fleet of them picking up passengers and taking them, you know, 100 miles away in 40 minutes. I got to wonder, they had some controversy recently, and I got to wonder if it's not a smokescreen, you know, kind of like, Hey, what about the controversy? Hey, you know what we're doing? We're making flying cars pretty soon.
Drop you off
in St. Louis.
Yeah, Bill, that's an interesting topic, and thank you for the call. We appreciate it. You never know. Part of me says no, they're not doing that.
Well, even if it is, it's a good smokescreen. Yeah. Flying cars.
Man, if companies just mess things up all the time, we'd really advance some technology.
Right?
Here,
what's the saying? Out of necessity comes the mother of invention or something?
I don't know.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah. They needed a smoke screen, and now they're like, flying cars. And we're like, that sounds great.
You know what? It's interesting that, and Bill, again, we appreciate the call. Here's the last paragraph of the Wired article. Whatever the answers, Uber likely sees another benefit to the blue sky thinking. It's a nice way to distract from all the problems it's having on the ground, from its legal fight with Google's Waymo to the latest accusation that it keeps tabs on riders who have deleted its app. I didn't know that. Had you heard that?
Everybody's watching you.
I'm just like, you know what? The price we pay for convenience. Great. But hey, if Uber can finally get you in that flying car, maybe you'll be ready to forgive and to fly.
Well, and you also have to think, if they're having problems on the ground, I'm sure there'll be some in the sky.
Right. We got to take a quick commercial break before the news here on 720 WGN. Viva! 720 WGN, John Hansen and Esmeralda Leon filling in for Matt
Bubala
on this Saturday morning. At the turn of the last century, Eustacios Rosales came to the United States from Colombia as a young man. He was a musician, and he, at some point, wrote a fascinating opera that had kind of gotten put in a box, I guess you could say, and stored away, passed down for a few generations, until Arlen Parsa discovered it 2 years ago and decided to turn it into, well, make it come to fruition and to turn it into a movie, that process. And Arlen joins us now. Arlen, this is a fascinating story. I'm sure you get that a lot when you talk about it. But how cool is this?
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here with you guys.
And this film is called The Way to... will you tell us? What's it called again?
The Way to Ondina. It's a documentary.
And it's a documentary, and it's being played at the Chicago Latino Film Festival this afternoon at 3:30 and on Monday as well. But the story is incredible, so I want to back up a little bit.
Sure.
Did you know that your great-grandfather was a musician and a composer? Had he done other works as well? Is he well-known, or was it more of a secret that had been passed, not a secret, but a story that had been passed on through generations?
Sure. This is sort of the weird thing. I had heard that my great-grandfather, Eustacio Rosales, was a composer, but I had never heard any of the music that he wrote. In fact, nobody in my family that's alive today had heard the music that he wrote about 100 years ago. This is because he died when recorded music was just starting to become a thing, so we had basically no idea what his work sounded like. And then here's the weird thing. So you guys, have you ever done the thing where you search for your name on the internet just to see what comes up?
Yeah.
Okay, we're all narcissists.
Oh,
we've
all
done Googled
that.
Yeah, all right?
Sure. I Google myself twice a day.
Talking into microphones, of course.
So my mother did this a couple years ago, and she searched for like my name, her mother's father's name, which is Eustacio Rosales, and she found the weirdest thing. She found videos of people performing some music that he wrote a century ago and uploading it to YouTube, which is crazy, right? So that kind of started this ball rolling, and we thought, well, gosh, this is the first time we've heard his music. Apparently, one song that he wrote a century ago is good enough to be performed today. What about the rest of his music? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where this journey started.
So when you say the rest of his music, you obviously knew there had to be, or you hoped, I imagine, that it would still exist, because obviously this was before the digital age where things could be digitized. So did you start going exploring through old boxes in the house to try and find it? Or did you know it was somewhere and you had to dig around? How did that process go?
I was basically the only one who didn't know, because I'm the youngest one in the family and the story hadn't really been told to me yet. But I started asking questions, right? I heard this music. I got really, really curious about this ancestor that I'd never met. And then my aunt invited me over to her house. She said, let's look around in the basement. We pulled out these two very heavy boxes, and they turned out to be boxes of music full of sheet music that was written, 100 years ago. And the very first thing in those boxes was this 80-year-old opera on Dina that has never been performed.
Wow. Did you get goosebumps?
I got a little bit of goosebumps. And of course, because I'm a documentary filmmaker, we were recording this whole process. So when you come see the documentary, The Way to On Dina, you'll see that first moment when I lay eyes on that opera, and it kind of gives you a shiver up your spine. And I'm like, holy cow, what is this thing?
Mm-hmm. And your aunt, was she just kind of like, yeah, there I have this.
Yeah, it's fine.
She's Deborah has a very sort of she's a little understated, right? Okay. Is her personality. So it turns out, and this is what I learned very shortly afterward, is this opera has been passed down from generation to generation in my family. Mm-hmm. And it turns out people have been trying to get this show performed for 80 years, ever since he died, because he died right in the middle of the Great Depression. There wasn't a lot of music to put on operas by unknown composers. And so that music went in a box, and it got passed down from generation to generation. And we have letters that are, you know, decades old from family members trying to reach out to people. Hey, can you put on this opera? We have this opera that's, we don't know if it's good or not, but can you put it? And it basically went nowhere. And so I took a look at it, and I thought, well, gosh, maybe we could finally put this thing on and kind of give it a world premiere 80 years late.
So this is your grandmother's father, right?
Yes, you got it.
And we've got a clip of her kind of remembering her father's opera. Let's take a listen to it.
She would sing and practice quite often Daddy's opera. And it was full of sadness, full of longing. We couldn't stand it. We would go to Mother and we would throw our arms around her knees and beg her, don't sing, Mother. Please don't sing.
Oh, my gosh. So that's fascinating in of itself, like stop singing the music. But when you were looking, obviously, at the sheet music, you don't have a musical background.
Yeah, gosh, you're telling everybody this. Well, huh?
You told us on TV that. I'm allowed to repeat
it,
right?
The truth is, I had no idea what I was doing. I was a total novice at this. You know, when I was looking at the sheet music, I could barely tell if it was upside down or right side up, because I knew absolutely nothing. And the other piece of this puzzle was the music's in Spanish. You know, I don't speak Spanish. So looking at it, it was in a totally different language, not just because it was in music, but because the opera is in Spanish. So I was looking at this thing. I was clueless. I didn't know where to begin. Let me ask you guys, what's the first thing? Let's say you found your ancestor wrote this opera. You guys are come up with the idea that you're going to put it on. What's the first thing you guys would do?
I would have, playing piano, I would sit down and try and play something.
Okay, so you are the wrong person to ask, because you actually have an idea. What about you?
I know nothing about music.
What would you do?
Oh my gosh. I would, you know what? Maybe I would try, I would think that it was done somewhere. So I would try to Google.
You do more Googling?
I would do more Googling, because I'm like, maybe there's somebody.
Yeah,
something.
Someone played this.
See, here's the thing. I did that. Nobody performed it, but it turns out I Googled, you know, how do you perform an opera?
There you go.
Turns out there is nothing on the internet that is remotely helpful for that query, right? But I searched some more, and I looked around, and eventually I sort of fell down a rabbit hole and got connected with this great, amazing, award-winning conductor, Chris Ramakers. And I had him to take a look at the material, and he was like, whoa, this is really interesting. And he kind of had an idea of what it sounded like, but I had no idea. And he was like, you know what, let's give this thing a try. Let's get in a room with some singers, and let's try and just pound it out with piano music, see what this music sounds like.
For me, if I was one of your family members and you were doing this, I would be enthralled. I'd be like, this is so cool. I'm so behind this. I think we have a clip of your family discussing your plans to put on the opera.
Okay, so we have this long-lost opera that has never been performed. Why not give it its world premiere?
How much experience does Arlen have with opera?
None.
I think none.
Is Arlen the right person to do this?
That is a good question.
When you hear that Arlen's putting on an opera, does that bring up any concerns at all?
It's nice to think that it's not very difficult, but it takes a lot.
He doesn't know anybody who's composes opera music. He doesn't really have the like production knowledge, doesn't have the connections either. It's a big task.
And you're his girlfriend?
So, wow. I guess supportive isn't the right word. I guess skeptical.
There was some healthy skepticism, but, you know, the family was supportive of the project. Obviously, they wanted to know just as much as I want to know, what does this music sound like? And even though I was the wrong person to take on this project in a lot of ways, I was kind of the only person left.
Was there anybody in the family that is musical in any way, or they kind of were like, oh.
Yeah, did he pass on any of this to anybody besides just the sheet music?
We had a couple musicians in our family, and the last one left is Deborah, my aunt. She's the one who had this opera hiding in her basement. So she had maybe just a tiny inkling, but she's more into rock music. So classical for her was just like a fish out of water, just like it was for me.
All right, so we got to take a quick break, but we're going to find out how this opera came to fruition and how you can see this really cool movie. More with Arlen Parsa after this on 720 WGN. That was me and Esmeralda singing there really quickly, a little
just
bit
warming up,
of the opera. Arlen Parsa joining us right now, talking about an opera that was really brought to life, and it could have been lost to the ages, Arlen. I mean, it was found in a basement. There were parts of it that were water damage from basement floods, but enough of it survived in order to make it. It was your great-grandfather's. It had never been performed. And the documentary that you made, your filmmaker, about the journey of this opera coming to life, is at the Latino Film Festival. And just remind people, that is today, right?
That is today, yeah. We're showing it today at 3:30 at the AMC River East in downtown Chicago.
Oh, on the big screen. There you go.
Yeah, that's right. If you want to get tickets, you can go to andinalives.com.
A-N-D-I-N-A. Okay, backing up a little bit, you asked us what we would do if we were presented with this. And even after I maybe would have played a few bars and heard what it was like, the thing I would have needed next to even try to get someone to perform this would be money. I mean, these things don't just happen. I mean, I'm sure people would be curious and maybe sing a few bars, but you're not going to get this thing on stage unless you have some resources. So how did that happen?
Yeah, so basically it's sort of the next step. Once we started gathering a team around the project, people who were just as curious as we were about what does this music sound like, we had to raise some funds. So we did a couple different things. We got some grants from the City of Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs. We also did a little bit of Kickstarter funding.
The grants could not have been easy. Did you have a background in that, or how did you know even to ask them? I mean, really, I mean, because people don't even think to write grants or ask for money through that way.
Right.
So yeah. You just knew that they would maybe help you out, or?
Well, because of my background in documentary, I'd gotten a little bit of funding from them in the past for previous documentary projects. So I was, you know, not really buddies with them, but at least familiar with the grant process. Mm-hmm. So we did that. We kind of held out our hand for money on the internet through Kickstarter and got generous donations from individuals who were curious about this, enthused by the story, interested in what the opera sounded like. Some of them were fans of opera music, and other people were just like me and kind of beginning this journey of getting familiar with that sort of thing and just curious.
What you mentioned to us during the commercial break, that because you showed us on You and Me, the show on WCIU I'm on, that you showed me the score, the orchestral score, and it looked in really great shape, but not everything was in good shape.
That's right. You know, with an opera, you have, I didn't know this, but you had several different pieces. So there's the full orchestral score, which is what the conductor would have when he's kind of conducting it. And then you also have the parts. So you have, you know, the violinist parts, the percussion parts, the, you know, the tuba part. And then you also have a piano vocal score, which is what the singers use for rehearsal. That little clip that we heard right when we came back from commercial was from the piano vocal first read when we just kind of gave it a try. It's just the singers and a piano player. And that's the part that was basically crumbling. It was falling apart. And so it's this tattered manuscript. We scanned it and then we digitized the music. So we actually typed it up in a program called Finale. So it looks nice and clean and new, even though it's 80 years old.
Oh, wow.
And then you obviously had to find the composer, the musicians, and then the theater to do this. And it's not like it's a play where, you know, I think not to say that there's actors everywhere that could perform plays, but opera is its own so unique thing. There aren't many people that can perform that. How did you find people that could sing this stuff?
Well, luckily, Chris Raymaker, our conductor, was you know, extremely connected in the world of Chicago music. And so he kind of roped together this amazingly talented group of opera singers. And, you know, for me, it was kind of wild being around these really, really talented singers because, you know, and there's a scene in the film, The Way to Ondina, the documentary that we made about the process, where they kind of try and get me to sing operatically.
Oh, no.
And that is a clip we are not playing on the radio.
I was going to say, it's not on my list here.
It is on the list. It is an embarrassing moment, but it's kind of funny. So it's in the film. But, you know, these people, their voice is incredible, and I just have so much respect for the amount of talent and the years and years and years of training that they've trained their, you know, their diaphragms to sing like that. It's incredible because they don't use microphones.
I imagine that the singers were really fascinated. I mean, that's a really cool project they're about, and I think we have a clip from the movie about singers discussing bringing that music back to life.
The cool part about this is it is a lush sound and the colors are dark and it's rich. And so that's really cool to be in that as a singer. And then the composer was careful in picking and choosing his moments to give you that contrast.
It just keeps rolling and it just takes you, it's very evocative. It's very exciting. It's like a little treasure hunt.
Cool to think about that the music itself was in a box and all these sounds were there, but they never lived. And then today they got to live a little bit.
Was there ever a worry that that the opera would just be bad?
Constantly,
you know what I mean? Right?
Constantly. I'm kind of a naturally anxious person. So, you know, at the beginning, you know, I was concerned, well, gosh, am I even going to like this music, right? Like opera music, like I'm a young person, right? So like Kanye is on my playlist, Taylor Swift's on my playlist, opera music, not so much. And so it was kind of like, I was worried, you know, is this thing even worth bringing to life? And I struggled with that.
Was there a reason why it was in the box? You know, like,
exactly.
Right. Maybe he didn't like it. And that's a question maybe you'll never get answered. But as you started to hear it and as you heard from the composer and the musicians, did that start to alleviate some of your fears by them, you know, saying it's good. It's wonderful.
Yeah. You know, hearing it for that very first time when we had just five singers and a piano, my eyes opened a little bit because I kind of went in expecting to hate it, right? It was going to be sort of this boring opera music. And instead it was lush. It almost sounded like a cinematic score because it's rolling and it just continues. And it's this beautiful, beautiful, gorgeous kind of music. And the other piece of that is that it kind of has these Latin American vibes because my great-grandfather, Eustacio Rosales, was originally from Colombia. He was an immigrant composer. We believe he was Chicago's first Hispanic composer. And so the music is kind of this combination of classical music on the one hand, but also kind of these Latin American rhythms, which is a combination that a lot of people, myself included, had not heard before this opera.
And in the end, how many people did you use?
To perform it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had five singers. We had a small chorus. We also had about 40 musicians with the Chicago Composers Orchestra.
Wow.
These people, I tell you, they move mountains to put on music. It is absolutely incredible. And the sound of this music, when you see it in the documentary at the end of the film, you get to see sort of the finale when we finally answer the question of what this music sounds like. It just sounds incredible.
All right, so I got more to dive into because I want to hear about that day that you finally got to be able to put it on and extra things that you found out about your great-grandfather through this journey, and I imagine some things that you found out about yourself as well. We got to take a quick break here on 720 WGN. WGN, John Hanson, Esmeralda Leon filling in for Matt Bubala. And Arlen, I got to say, it does sound a little scory, music scory, some of this music. And this is, we're hearing from Ondina. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, you got
just
it.
Making sure. It's an 80-year-old opera written by immigrant composer Eustacio Rosales. The score was never performed until Arlen Parsa, his great-grandson, discovered the work and began researching the composer's story. And he's determined to fulfill the family legacy, resurrect the opera decades after it was first written, and that's all taking place in the film The Way to Ondina. Why do I want to say it differently? I don't know why.
Ondina.
And it's at the Chicago Latino Film Festival this afternoon.
Yeah,
that's going to be exciting. A little Q&A, too, Esmeralda was asking. asking? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll be there. Other people from the opera documentary process will be there. It'll be fun at 3:30 at the AMC River East.
That's really cool. Okay, so you where we left off is you had gotten the musicians together. You had started to hear the music being put together. How did this manifest itself? Was it a one-night showing? Was it open to the public? What happened?
Yeah, absolutely. We formed a partnership with the Athenaeum Theater here in Chicago. This absolutely beautiful, gorgeous opera house. It was actually created by German immigrants over 100 years ago. And so we put on this show. We weren't sure if people were going to come, but a lot of people came. They mm-hmm. were just as curious as we were about what did this music sound like. And so we put on the show, and of course we filmed it for the documentary. So when you see the documentary, The Way to Ondina, you're going to be able to see the whole process from first sort of discovering this opera in a box to the rehearsals to put it on and all the steps that it sort of took and me sort of bumbling around because I didn't know the first thing about putting on an opera. Mm-hmm. And then you'll finally get to hear that kind of beautiful, gorgeous performance that we just heard a clip from.
So what I find fascinating is I can almost picture, even though you didn't write it, you aren't singing in it, you have none of the acting, you're not on stage. Were you pacing around? Were you worried as if you were channeling how I imagine your great-grandfather would have been on the head of a premiere of something like this?
A little bit. You know, my leg was a little bit jittering. My hands might have been shaking a little bit. I for a while, I was starting to think maybe this opera was haunted because so many people in our family had tried to get it performed for like 8 years.
Oh, wait,
and things
really?
Just kept going wrong.
Okay.
Yeah. So things kind of just kept going wrong, and as it was sort of counting down to those final moments, we had problems in the score, and we discovered that, the piano vocal score doesn't match, you know, the orchestral score, and how do we make these kind of work together? And so it was kind of this last-minute fight to put on the opera and have it not be a disaster.
Wait, looking back in the past, what were some of the other reasons? Anything spooky or just basic logistics things that couldn't
just
make it?
Just people not being interested. You know, okay. here was this immigrant composer. He came here from Colombia, and nobody was interested in his music. It turns out he did have music performed with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra in early 1930s, and he was actually the first Latino person to have music performed there that he wrote. But the music just, you know, he died right after that, and so mm-hmm. he didn't really manage to get a name. He didn't get to leverage that into getting attention for his work for his long-lost opera, Ondina.
It's fascinating stuff. I'm trying to look up. You probably might know this off the top of your head because it's a fascinating documentary. This sort of reminds me of Vivian Maier, the photographer, and her story, which is an incredible documentary the way they did that.
Finding Vivian Maier.
Yeah. Now, she was completely unknown. And so there are differences in that your great-grandfather obviously had some music performed on a high level and a mm-hmm. high scale and was known in the community, was Googleable. Vivian Maier was not until she passed away, obviously, and her stuff was discovered. But I think that, and you and I kind of chatted about this off the air, the idea of this, you know, well, not everyone's great-grandfather was a composer or has this great work of art that's hidden. Maybe I connected this to, because my grandfather was a watercolor painter.
Oh, is that right?
And has hundreds of original prints that are incredible. Now, he was a pretty well-known watercolor painter, but it's so great to have a legacy. Like, each of us, every couple of Christmases, we get one of these paintings after he passed away because they're priceless, but they're incredible works of art. But I think everyone can relate to this, just the idea of finding a little bit about your family history and connecting to that. Did you feel like a connection to him when this stuff was going on, or were you able to kind of separate yourself from it as a documentarian?
Well, you know, that's kind of really the difficult thing that I struggle with because, you know, I'm in the documentary film and kind of bumbling around as kind of like this clown character trying to put on this opera with no experience. But, you know, going through the steps and even just touching that sheet music that he hand wrote decades ago, you kind of feel like this connection to this ancestor. And what you were saying, I think, is so true, John, because everybody has questions about their ancestors, right? We all kind of have that shoebox full of photos that's under the bed, and we see the pictures, but we don't know the stories behind them. And so I think everybody would love to be able to meet, you know, somebody from their family tree 100 years ago. And for me, this was kind of just the next best thing, getting to know this ancestor of mine, Eustacio Rosales, through the music that he wrote.
How about you, Esmeralda? Anyone in the past you wish you could talk about?
I have my dad's dad, my grandfather. We barely know anything about him. He came from China. to Guatemala.
Really?
Yeah, and he died young, so he left a slew of kids, but no one really knows that much about him. Like, my dad barely knows his proper name. Because he was Chinese and he goes to Guatemala. And they're like, that's a weird name. We're going to change it.
Yeah.
What a fascinating journey. So, yeah, he's Ramon. He's Ramon Leon. But that's like, that's not your real name. You came from China. That cannot be your real proper name. So, yeah, that's a big mystery in our family.
So, after the opera was performed, and when was it? This was a couple of years ago, right?
This was in 2015.
Okay. What was the reception to the actual show itself?
It was pretty good, yeah. We got a few reviews of it done.
Actual reviews as if they weren't like, oh, this is an amazing story, but let's actually review the opera itself.
Yeah, yeah. People liked the opera. They hated the ending.
What? Really?
Yeah, it kind of comes out of nowhere. The plot, so it was written by, the music was written by my great-grandfather, Eustacio Rosales, and then the libretto, the lyrics, the plot was written by his brother, Jose Miguel.
Really?
And yeah, so it was kind of this brother teamwork collaboration, and the story is kind of the story of the opera. It takes place at the foothills of the Andes Mountains,
okay,
in South America, and the show is in Spanish. And basically, it's you have sort of an unrequited love story, right? Your typical opera, you know, someone loves someone else and they don't love them back, and then it's not a love triangle; it's more of a love parallelogram in this case, because there's like four people trying to get with each other. But someone dies in the end, and it's kind of a tragic thing that nobody's expecting. So
isn't that how all operas end, though? Doesn't someone die at the end, or was this what a real
it just
turn
sounds
of the
like
screw?
It does.
Well, the thing is, I think what throws people off is there's humor in the opera, so they're kind of expecting it's going to be light, but then there's kind of this tragic ending. So people loved the music, hated the ending of the opera.
Really? What was it like reading, or I guess not negative reviews, but again, that's another interesting thing. You're so connected to the project. You wanted, I'm sure, to be a huge success and to be this wonderful thing. But at the same time, as a documentarian, you want the honest truth from people.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, the thing, it's kind of like, well, my great-grandfather, right, he wrote beautiful music. The lyrics, you know, are kind of their own thing, and the plot is its own thing.
Yeah, but that's still blood relation, yeah, sort of your great great uncle or something.
Still family.
Still family. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. All right, we're going to wrap things up after this quick commercial break. We're going to talk about what you learned a little bit more about your great-grandfather and maybe a little bit about yourself, too, here on 720 WGN. Okay, 720 WGN. This is when Juan rebuffs Inez. Wow. Do you have the translation ready for us, Esmeralda, or no?
I don't. What did he see? They were. I don't remember now. Just what they said.
I should have asked you while it was happening.
He was
happening.
Like, yes, no, yeah. It was kind of, they were just going back and forth.
I heard Juan in there.
Yeah,
that
I think
translates
they were just
to John. So
John,
I heard that.
Yeah, Juan. Good job.
So that's when I rebuff Inez. Okay, that was from the opera Andina, which is an incredible piece of work with a crazy ending, and it was stuck in a box for decades and been brought to life by the great-grandson of the composer, and he joins us now, Arlen Parsa. Just a fascinating story. What more did you learn about your great-grandfather through this exploration process, besides the fact that he obviously could write an opera?
Yeah, you know, for me, it was kind of this journey of discovery, right? Because I knew just about nothing about the man who wrote this music. And, you know, I could hear the music in rehearsals, but I had all kinds of different questions I would love to ask him, as I'm sure everybody has questions that they want to ask their ancestors, right? We've all done, like, maybe it's the Ancestry.com family tree thing. We all have these questions. And so as part of the process, I listened to these oral history audio tapes from my grandmother, Paula. She's dead now, but before she died, she left behind these recordings. And
oh my gosh.
She, yeah.
That's awesome.
Very smart.
For me, as a documentary filmmaker, it was kind of like a treasure trove, right? And in the film, I sort of find the tapes, and we get to hear what she says, both about the opera and also about her father's life, this immigrant composer from Latin America. And one of the stories that she tells on there is this kind of heartbreaking story, because Eustacio Rosales, right, he comes here from Bogota, South America, Colombia, right? And he comes here around the turn of the 20th century. He falls in love with a Chicago woman. Her name was Mary. Mary was an American through and through. Her family had been here since the Revolutionary War, right?
Wow.
Like, they fought alongside George Washington. But when she married Eustacio, this foreigner, she actually lost her American citizenship, if you can believe that.
I can't believe that almost. That's crazy. Yeah.
Congress had passed this crazy, crazy immigration law in the early 1900s that basically said that if an American woman married a foreign man, she was no longer an American. So she lost all of her citizenship, and she found out that she was no longer a citizen when she went to vote for the first time in the early 1920s. And so there she is. She's standing in line trying to get, you know, registered to vote. And then she hears this absolutely heartbreaking news. I'm sorry, ma'am, you're not an American anymore because of the man you loved, the man you married, this immigrant composer. So when I found this out, it kind of, you know, turned my head upside down. And I started thinking about, you know, well, gosh, you know, it this terrible, you know, if I can be living right now in 2017 thinking, you know, that immigration law 100 years ago was really, really inhumane. What are people going to think about the immigration laws that we have today, 100 years from now? And it made me reflect on that and kind of give me some cause for concern.
I find that fascinating. So Mary then, and she is your great-grandmother then, right? Yes, so they stay married. Obviously, they had kids. What's fascinating about that is you mentioned her first time to vote in the early 1920s. Obviously, the first time women could vote in that time. So I imagine the excitement that she must have had to vote. And not only the news that she can't vote, but that she's not an American citizen. How soul-crushing that must have been. Also, can we talk about how cool it is that your grandma did that, the audio tapes? I'm just relying on Tom Hush to podcast everything of mine so that you have it for later.
It's insanely smart. No one,
I know.
Usually people are just like, yeah, no. These stories happen, but nobody's asked me, so I didn't do anything about it. Yeah.
So that's fascinating. What else about your great-grandfather? So you say that you actually ended up working near where he worked in Chicago, which is interesting because you live in Chicago now, but you come here through the way of the East Coast.
Yeah, my family has this kind of on-again, off-again relationship with the city of Chicago.
Same here. It's fine.
Basically, you know, my great-grandfather is an immigrant composer, Eustacio Rosales. He came here from Colombia in the early 1900s, and then my family lived here for a couple generations, and then we moved away. And I actually grew up in New Hampshire, about 1,000 miles away, and I moved back to Chicago and ended up working right down the street from where he used to work on LaSalle Street. Turns out he was kind of this rooftop nightclub conductor. He had Señor Rosales's Latin band.
Really?
And he kind of helped popularize the tango to Chicago, music that Americans hadn't heard before. But it was kind of wild to learn these connections and kind of just pure happenstance, just happened to move 1,000 miles away back to his old neighborhood.
Wow. Did you know when you came back to Chicago that you had these connections to the city?
No. Well, I knew that I had a little bit of family that lived here, but I didn't know anything about this great-grandfather, this ancestor of mine.
I think that's probably something that a lot of people, I mean, I think everyone knows who their grandparents were, or most people do, I should say. But then when you get that one next generation, when you lose those stories, that's kind of where things start to cut off, and it drops even further than that. Did you learn anything about yourself when you go through this process? Or did you stay enough kind of, I know that's such a silly question to ask a filmmaker, you're giggling, but I mean, did you? Did you stay separated enough from it emotionally that you were able to play the role as a documentarian?
No. I think it's pretty hard not to learn about yourself when you kind of go through any type of journey like this. And for me, it really was an adventure to try and put on this long lost opera, despite not knowing the first thing about opera. I have to say, I learned a lot about how to get things done, right? How to produce things, not just an opera, but the documentary behind this whole process. And I think I learned a little bit about kind of the value of determination. You know, this opera almost came together a couple times over 80 years, and it kept falling apart. And so for me, kind of just running through a wall to try and put on this opera was the hardest thing I've ever done, but it changed me as a person.
I'm looking at an old article from WFMT.com, old, a couple of years ago, I should say, when this opera debuted. And at the top of it is this illustration. I think it's you or it's someone with this How to Resurrect Your Great-Grandfather's Long-Lost Opera for Dummies book in front of it. But yeah, I mean, I think you probably learned that we all, and I think that anyone that goes through a journey not necessarily identical to this, but something where you discover something and you really go further. Because, I mean, at the beginning of this project, did you really think it would end up where it ended up?
honestly, it was totally implausible, right? There was no reason to think that we would be able to put on this opera. People had tried and failed in the past for generations, and here's this guy who comes with the least amount of experience trying to put this thing on. There was no reason to think that we could accomplish this goal. But at the end of the day, I think it's a testimony to the amount of talent and commitment that the people who worked on this project, who were so into it, solving this mystery of what does this music sound like, that they came on board and they basically poured their heart and soul into it.
And now that you've put out the opera, has anything come out of the woodwork from your great-grandfather?
You know, it's wild because it turns out you put on a long-lost opera and you start getting emails from halfway around the globe. It's the weirdest thing. I had people down in South America contact me. I have a long-lost relative. We thought everybody died down in South America. I had a long-lost relative look me up on Facebook. I had a music historian down in Colombia, and he contacted me, and we're actually going to put on this piece that he performed for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra he wrote in the 1930s. The Colombian National Symphony Orchestra is going to perform that in August. So we're kind of bringing his music amazing. Full circle all the way back down to South America.
And is there any other...
That gave
me
goosebumps, by the way. Yeah.
Is there any more plans to put the opera on again anywhere?
We'd love to. If there are any opera companies out there listening.
That's our big demo, I got to say. Yeah. Between 4:30 and 5, that's when the opera company...
I mean, hey, somebody's got to know somebody.
Somebody knows someone who runs an opera. That's
right,
the
yeah, and any opera house is out there.
Touring group. No, this is absolutely fascinating. So remind people where they can see the film today.
Absolutely. So here in Chicago, it's playing at the Chicago Latino Film Festival. The name of the documentary is The Way to Ondina. If you want to get tickets, you can go to OndinaLives, OndinaLives.com, and you can also go to the AMC River East at 3:30 p.m. It's also showing at on Monday at 5:30 p.m.
We have listeners all over the place, so is there any way to watch this online, or is it strictly only viewing these sorts of things?
Yeah, so if you're outside Chicago, we would love to bring the film to your town or city if you want to set up a screening.
So if you own a theater or an opera.
Or an opera. You can do the opera in the theater.
Demographics
give
the show.
Give the website again. Sorry, I talked over you.
AndinaLives.com. You can also sign up on our newsletter. We'll let you know when the film is available to stream online.
It's really cool stuff. Arlen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, really appreciate it. All right, we're going to wrap things up next on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Wow, what a fascinating discussion that was.
Very much so.
I got goosebumps a bunch of times throughout the show there. I don't know. Well, especially the last part, hour. First hour when we were talking about peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, not so many goosebumps
moldy
there.
Moldy bread.
Yeah, moldy bread. That didn't give me so many goosebumps. It's always been a blast, Esmeralda.
Yes, ditto.
It's been a blast.
Very much so.
And the blast will continue because we've got the Saturday morning show with Orion Samuelson coming up. Orion, how you doing?
Doing much better, thank you. It's been a long road back. It started back on the 1st of March with leg bypass surgery, and it's a little slow coming back. But the voice at least wasn't affected, and so I'm looking forward to my first time on the Saturday morning show in about 2.5 months.
Yeah, you know, Orion, I got to ask you one question, because obviously the big story today is all the rain that's going to be coming through all across the state in the Midwest. And this is a really dumb question, because it's planting season, right? And
it is planting season.
So, you know, I'm going down to Champaign-Urbana a little bit later today, and I know that some of those areas down there are going to get 5 or 6 inches of rain. Does that mess everything up, or is that really good for the planting season?
Well, if it doesn't come in flood stages so that fields get flooded and you have the newly planted seed in standing water, it's fine because it starts us off with a good supply of moisture. So I guess at this point, it's too early to get really concerned about late planting because we've already got corn and some soybeans that are out of the ground and growing in the Midwest. And so... there's a saying at the Board of Trade, rain makes grain. And so we will take rain at this point. If it gets to flood stage, then it's not so good.
But well, I'm heading down there. I'll make sure it doesn't get to flood stage. I'll get my sandbags
out. Will you make sure
that? Yeah, absolutely. All right, this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. And if you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio. I got my Amazon Echo right here. Play the news, Roger Badish.